MechCast, Wednesday, September 10th, 2014. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's time for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, are you as just overwhelmed, excited, tired? I don't know all the emotions I'm feeling at this point by the stuff that we heard yesterday. Apple had their big event of the year, the 9/9/2014 event, where they announced all kinds of cool new products, including new iPhones, brand new watch, the Apple Watch, along with their new payment system, Apple Pay. And if you hadn't heard about that stuff yet, then I don't know where you've been living, under some rock somewhere, because that's all that's been in the news, on the blogs, on the internet, on Twitter, everything over the past 24 hours. And I have been busy just attempting to consume as much information as I possibly can get to talk to you about. Because while Apple does a great job presenting their products, there's always, always when Apple has these events, some holes, some things that we don't know, some questions that are left behind. And I really, as you know, after these events, I don't rush to get something out there because there are a lot of these unanswered questions, and I want to get at least some of them answered for you. So I have been culling, perusing, reading, digging, twittering, doing everything I can to hopefully get you some of the answers to some of the burning questions related to what Apple announced. And of course, that's all we're going to be talking about in this episode. This is all about Apple's event. So we're going to be diving in, digging into all the nitty-gritty. We're going to kind of cover the flow. As such, my notes are a little more disjointed than they normally are. So we may be jumping around a little bit. Bear with me on that. But I wanted to make sure I got this out at least within 24 hours because guess what? The phones, they're going on sale at the end of the week. So some of you may be wondering, what am I going to buy? What does Adam think? What does the community think? So we're going to try and get all of that stuff in this episode. So it should be a lot of fun. It's going to kind of continue the buzz that's been going since yesterday, and I hope you really enjoy it. But before we dive in and get to everything, I want to thank a couple of my sponsors right here up front, so then we can just dive into all the juicy Apple details. But these guys are really important. They support us, and so I'd like you to support them. Gazelle, you know what? New iPhones are out. So if you're thinking about getting the new phone, Gazelle wants to buy your current phone, and that means you can get cash that you can use to buy that shiny new iPhone 6. And Gazelle will even buy your broken iPhone, so don't worry if you've got a damaged one. They take those back too. And what I love about Gazelle is they make selling your used iPhone just fast and simple. It really couldn't be simpler. You just go to gazelle.com, that's G-A-Z-E-L-L-E.com. You do a search for your iPhone. There's buttons right there. A little wizard walks you right through it. Tell them about which phone you have, which model, whether it's Verizon, AT&T, whatever your carrier is. If it's unlocked, even better. Tell them a little bit about the condition, and then they will give you a risk-free offer right there on the screen. You can see it there, and they even give you free shipping, and in many cases will provide a box for you to send your old device in, along with the shipping label, everything that you need. And not only that, they'll do things like wipe all the data off your old device, and they do that for free as well. So you can wipe it off. I prefer to wipe it off before I send it in, but if you forget, something happens, they're going to take care of you there. And to date, they've paid nearly $175 million to over 1 million satisfied customers. So they have been doing this, I think, longer than anyone. You get paid fast. They can pay you by check, by PayPal, or even get an extra 5% if you choose to get paid with an Amazon gift card. That's what I like to do because I use my Amazon account all the time. I have Amazon Prime. So it's a great option, and you get even more on your Gazelle offer. The processing is fast and simple. Once they receive it, they process it very quickly. As long as everything checks out, you get paid. And like I said, they're going to cover the shipping, the box. What could be simpler? Really, nothing could be simpler. And now's the time to do it. Every day that you wait, those offers can change. They can go down. So you want to get in there. You want to go to gazelle.com and get an offer for your iPhone. Lock in your price and get cash that you can use for that new iPhone purchase. Gazelle, big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. I'd also like to really thank lynda.com. If you are looking to get up to date with your software, if you're looking to pick up some new skills at work, if you're just a hobbyist looking to explore a new hobby, Lynda provides really easy to follow video tutorials on all kinds of topics: technology, computers, programming, photography. They have over 2,400 courses taught by industry experts, and they're adding more video courses all the time. And these are high-quality courses. That's what I love about Lynda.com. The production value is incredible. They have great audio, great video, screencasts that you can actually see, which is really important when you're trying to learn a new topic. And like I said, they use the best instructors. These people are tops in their fields, and they really know what they're talking about. So you're learning from some of the best people who have been in the industry. And they cover all skill levels. So whether you're an advanced user looking to expand your skills, or maybe you're brand new to a topic and just wanting to get up to speed really, really quickly, they can help you with that. I've used lynda.com a lot for doing web development, or learning more web development skills. I'm a web developer. New programming stuff is coming up all the time, and I use them for that. I can brush up on some of my skills and maybe even learn some new techniques, even on topics that I already know about. It's fun to go through and watch the videos. And they make it really easy to search and browse and find the videos that you want. And all of the videos and instructions are very well structured, and they're broken into bite-sized chunks. So you can go through the entire course all in one sitting, or you can take it a piece at a time. They've broken it down, and you can track your progress, come right back to where you started, you know, where you left off. They also have a mobile app, so if you need to get courses on your Apple or your Android devices, you can do it there. And their premium plans allow you even to download the project files and practice along with the instructor. And they do all of this for one low monthly price. $25 a month gives you unlimited access to the entire lynda.com library. And MacCast listeners, you can get a free trial with access to the entire course library just by going to lynda.com/MacCast. So I really like you to try it out. If you haven't checked out Lynda, you really should. That's lynda.com/MacCast to get your free trial and try it out. I know you're going to love it, and you're going to probably just want to sign up right away. So check it out. And a big thank you to lynda.com for their support of the MacCast. So let's talk Apple event, right? This thing was amazing. Amazing in many, many ways. There were a few little hiccups and issues. We're going to talk about those as well. But when they kicked this thing off, well, first of all, they returned back to, I don't want to say scene of the crime, scene of the most amazing announcement for Mac fans ever, the launching of the original Mac back in 1984. So they were at the Flint Center in Cupertino, right in Apple's own backyard. Normally, they do it over in San Francisco at the Yerba Buena Center. But this facility fit a lot more people. There was a huge crowd. I think it had capacity for something like 2,000, 3,000 people. And it was packed. Beautiful theater. And Apple built, as you know from what we talked about before the event, that giant sort of demo center right next to it. So we knew they were going to have a lot of things to show off, a lot of things for the invited press and media to check out. And they really invited a larger range of media to this event than they ever had before. A lot more bloggers seemed to get invitations, but not just in the tech industry, but also in the fashion industry and the health and fitness industries. So that kind of also gave us an indication that Apple was going to be doing something in those fields, and that certainly pretty much pointed to what turned out to be the Apple Watch. But another thing that was a little bit different about this event was that right from the bat, so normally, if you've watched Apple keynotes before, you know what goes on, right? They come in, they kind of talk about the state of the Mac, the state of Apple, the business stuff, before they actually get into the nitty-gritty, the products. And lately, these keynotes, because Apple's been packing everything together, they run about 2 hours. So they started about 10. I figured they'd be done about noon. And they usually spend that first 15, 20 minutes kind of doing that business stuff. They didn't do that this time. Tim Cook came out and he just basically said, you know what? Here's the rundown on Apple. Everything is great. We're doing well. Let's get right to the iPhone. And I think the crowd appreciated that, and I certainly did as well. I guess we should back up a little bit, though, because another thing that they were doing for this event, and they've done this the past few, but you know, a long time ago, they kind of had stopped doing it, and we might understand a little bit why, because live streaming is what I'm talking about. They were going to live stream this event. A lot of us were very excited. I had set up the MacCast IRC chat room. I know many of you were in there chatting away, and we were all excited to sit down and sort of watch this thing live, get all the details as they're streaming out of the Flint Center. And right away when I started listening, I knew there was going to be a problem because I had two bits of audio in my ears. I could hear music, two different music tracks going. So Apple's kind of always playing music right before the event starts. And the stream seemed to be going okay, the video, but it was just a little bit odd. And then immediately when they started up, they started to hit problems. The video started degrading. It started dropping out. We had like a Chinese translation audio mixed in with the regular audio. So I think they, you know, that's where they had the two audio streams coming from. And folks on Apple TVs noticed that it was practically inaccessible. They started getting error messages where they couldn't connect or they didn't have permissions to connect. It was just a mess. And you're thinking, man, Apple should have known. They should have planned for this. What the heck is going on? You know, who did they hire to do this? And whoever did get hired to do the streaming, they're probably not going to have a job after this. It was bad for about the first 30 minutes. And so we didn't really know what was going on. They finally kind of got it sorted out, and we were able to watch and move forward. But for the first part, you kind of had to rely on the blogs and the live blogs and the people that were there. So thank goodness those people were there still sending out information. But now, after the fact, we're getting some reports, some conflicting reports about what happened. Cult-O-Mac reported on a streaming expert who posted on his blog that he thought he had discovered the issue, that some JavaScript and some JSON code, those of you who are web programmers out there, basically some code that was enabling the live Twitter feed, because that was something that was also a little bit different on this keynote. When you went to the live page, Apple was kind of selectively reposting on their site Twitter tweets from anybody sending to hashtag, I think, Apple Live, I think was the hashtag. And so they were putting those up there. And in order to do that, they were using some JavaScript code. So this guy's theory was that that stuff was being auto-refreshed every few milliseconds for everybody's browser. And consequently, then Apple could not cache the video. So they've always used Akamai, this streaming service, for their video feed, and they were using Akamai again, but he was saying because they were doing that, they weren't able to cache the video. Also, it looked like Apple was using some Amazon S3 storage, maybe for some other things on the page, and that wasn't fully optimized to take advantage of like the edge networks that Amazon S3 has, meaning that they were having to serve all the images from one server on Amazon's S3 environment. Normally, that would be distributed geographically, so you'd be hitting a server closer to you to kind of mitigate the bandwidth. Don't want to go into too much of those technical details, but basically that's what he was saying. The thing was, is I was reading this and I was seeing this reported all over the internet, and I, you know, I'm a web developer, I've worked in web, and it didn't seem to jive up. So thank goodness that later on Twitter, Gideon Mayhew and Cabell Sasser from Panic and those guys started questioning. I think Marco Armont, guy who knows a little bit about streaming, right? He has a little podcast player, worked in audio, worked in programming. I think he knows a little bit about building stuff on the web. Worked for Tumblr, I believe, at 1.2. Kind of went, no, this isn't making any sense. And plus, you know what? The stream on the Apple TV was messed up as well. And there's no JSON or web code around that player. So just seems like Apple was just slammed by the load. Whoever they had hired obviously wasn't prepared for it. Maybe there's other technical issues. We never really know. We'll know what happened, but they were able to get it sorted out about 30 minutes in, and we're able to watch it. Luckily, I had an opportunity. Apple has the video up on their website now, so you can go back and get it on demand. I'm pretty sure it's also in the Keynote podcast, the Apple Keynote podcast, if you want to subscribe to that in iTunes, and you can watch the whole thing beginning to end in great quality video. And so I went back and watched everything and took copious notes for this episode. So there's some of that mixed in with a lot of my research just based on the past 24 hours of information coming out. But at the very start of it, as they've done the past few keynotes as well, they opened with a really cool, just sort of inspirational video talking about sort of Apple's philosophy and the consumer philosophy and things like that. And they used the effect, it looked like it was very much inspired by the latest OK Go video, if you've seen that. I'm trying to remember the name of the song. I should have written it down. But it's basically this continuous panning shot with a bunch of visual and perspective tricks that reveal text. So, you know, you'll be looking at a wall in one angle and it looks like there's just sort of random paint area, you know, painted areas, and then when the camera pans to a certain location, then it reveals that there's actually text there. And it's one continuous long shot where they're going through all these visual effects. And when you watch it, it's really, really cool. But what's funny was I immediately thought, oh, this looks a lot like that OK Go video. And today, OK Go actually came out on the internet and accused Apple of stealing their concept. They said they had gone to Apple to kind of pitch the video project and the concept because they wanted to partner with Apple, but Apple had said no. And so then they went off and hired their own production company to actually shoot the video and put it out. And I think it came out a couple weeks ago. Turns out Apple hired exactly the same production company to shoot this intro video. So whether or not they actually stole it, or even if it is a visual concept that sort of OK Go could patent, it very much was inspired by the style of that OK Go video. And the fact that they used the same production company is a little bit suspect. So a little bit of finger pointing and sort of name calling, I guess, or calling out going on there. But I thought the same thing, so it wasn't surprising when I saw that report come through. But very visually cool video. If you haven't had a chance to see it, again, it's up on Apple's website, and you can play just that portion of the video if you don't want to have to go back and rewatch the whole entire keynote. But then Tim Cook came out. He said, we're going to dive right into the iPhone, and we got actual details on the iPhone 6. Now, unfortunately, it looks like most of the leaks revealed most of the stuff about the iPhone 6 this time around. So we kind of already knew what was coming. There were a few surprises here and there. It is that design with the front glass that kind of curves around the sides. It's gorgeous, basically all screen on the front. You've got the stainless steel Apple logo embedded in the back. It comes in the standard array of colors that we're used to, gold, space gray, and silver. It does have the Tron antenna lines, as I'm calling them. This is basically those antenna lines that wrap around the end caps. And I'm still not thrilled with that design element. I'm reserving final judgment till I actually have one in my hands and I see it. They definitely have them better color matched, at least on the space gray. And the silver model, I still really, really don't like the gold model where those antenna lines are white. I think it just looks, I don't know, clunky. It looks like it's not seamless. It's not integrated. It just, it breaks up the lines. And maybe you can call that a style. If it is, it's a style that I'm not going to be a big fan of. So it'll be interesting to see if other manufacturers kind of take those design cues, because a lot of times whatever Apple does, you know, other people will sort of follow along. So we'll have to wait and see on that. As far as the screen itself, there was a lot of wondering about resolution. I guess that's one of the areas where there were a lot of different theories. Resolution of the display, what is it going to be made of? What about the glass? Is it going to be sapphire glass? Is it not? I had thought, I was in that camp that wanted to believe it was going to be sapphire glass. It turned out not to be sapphire. Apple is using something they're calling Ion X glass, which I guess is it's ion exchange glass. So the X stands for exchange, and they use some sort of process to further strengthen the glass. So it is supposed to be super strong. I don't know if it's Apple's own formulation or who they've worked with. We haven't gotten details on that, so I don't know if they were still working with Corning, the makers of Gorilla Glass, and it's some sort of new Gorilla Glass, but it definitely wasn't mentioned as Gorilla Glass. They just called it Ion X Glass. And the display itself is super color accurate. They made a big point of saying they tried to make it the most accurate display. It has sRGB, 100% sRGB accuracy. It's in four layers, so they've got the ultra-thin backlight, and then something they're calling a photo-aligned IPS liquid crystal display. And Apple says the display uses something called dual-domain pixels, another one of these marketing terms. So there's a lot of marketing terms. I'm trying to dig in and find the answers for you as to technically what do these things mean. What does photo-aligned IPS liquid crystal mean? What does dual-domain pixels mean? As far as you know what it means to us as consumers, according to Apple, dual domain pixels means we're going to get more accurate colors at wider viewing angles. And they say the photo alignment provides better alignment of the pixels, but I guess better alignment of the pixels maybe means sharper images, I would assume, on the screen. If if you happen to know what these sort of marketing terms translate into in terms of the actual technology that's in the LCD, I'd be curious to find that out. But I'm going to be doing some digging on that myself. They also say they have an improved polarizer, which I would assume helps with anti-glare, and then the strengthened glass on the top. So the four layers are the backlight, the liquid crystal itself, a polarizer, and then the ion glass on top. And Apple says this display is going to have deeper blacks and sharper text, which is always good in a display. They're calling them Retina HD. You have, I guess I should just say right up front, they did announce the two phone sizes, and we're going to be talking about those a lot. So you have what Apple is calling the iPhone 6, which is the 4.7-inch display, and then the iPhone 6 Plus, the 5.5-inch display version. And the resolutions of those turned out to be iPhone 6 is 1334 by 750. That's still at the same resolution, or the pixel density, excuse me, as the iPhone 5S. So 326 pixels per inch, so staying in that Retina range. And then iPhone 6 Plus is 1920 by 1080. So full 1080, that's like 1080p resolution, if I'm not mistaken. And that one has a pixel density of 401 pixels per inch. So I guess Apple's calling these both HD in terms of the resolution. Pixel densities are as good or slightly higher than the iPhone 5S. Now, what's interesting is that there was a theory, and I think John Gruber kind of threw this out. He nailed the 1334 by 750 resolution, saying that's basically 2X Retina. And that doesn't mean the 2X, a lot of people are confusing this. 2X doesn't mean, double the width, double the height. What we're talking about is the actual pixel density, the Retina resolution. And you have to use Pythagorean theorem to figure that out. So math people out there probably know how to do this, because you're looking at the diagonal and a bunch of things. You can go on Daring Fireball. Gruber has a great post on this that tells you how to do all the formula, how he built out these tables. But when he was doing that, he was kind of sticking at, okay, Apple's going to stick with the 326 pixel per inch resolution or better. And when you did a 3X Retina, that would bring the pixels per inch actually in a 5.5-inch screen up to 461 pixels per inch, which would mean a display size in terms of the pixel dimensions of 1242 by 2208, or 414 pixels by 736 pixels three times. But Apple's doing a display at 1920 by 1080, which is a lot smaller than that. But developers are saying that Apple is calling for 3X assets in Xcode, and they have sort of something in the simulator that simulates that 2208 by 1242 size. So it's looking like if you get the higher resolution screen, the iPhone 6 Plus screen, it's actually going to be rendering stuff at 2208 by 1242 and then scaling that back down to the 1920 by 1080 resolution, which is interesting to me. Apple does claim that in iOS 8, they have a desktop class scaler for scaling images, not only for, I guess, doing the downscaling maybe on the iPhone 6 Plus, but also for older apps that aren't updated for the new iPhone 6 screen. They're going to be able to scale up directly, because these are all roughly 16 by 9 displays, or for all intents and purposes, 16 by 9 displays. So you'll be able to take the iPhone 5S interface and just scale it up for the iPhone 6 if it hasn't been reprogrammed for that native resolution. So they're going to use that desktop class scaler, I guess, to handle that. And that's built into iOS 8 and sure leverages all the stuff that's in the new A8 chips. Of course, developers can also adjust their apps to take advantage of the larger displays, although Apple has been encouraging developers to build new adaptive apps using UIKit, part of Xcode. So they had a whole session at WWDC as sort of saying, you want to use this new method for building your adaptive apps. And that's, I'm we're all assuming because Apple's planning on having kind of different display sizes and resolutions, and so things are going to shift a little bit. And so by using that, the apps can just naturally adapt and still use the native graphics assets and those sorts of things. At least that's how I understand it. We probably need to get some real developers in here to talk to us about how this whole resolution thing works, because I'm still a little bit confused on it. So if you run across an article or find more information on sort of what's going on here, especially on the iPhone 6 Plus, shoot me an email, let me know. Then they did show that the iPhone 6 Plus is going to be able to take advantage of what they're calling two-up display modes in your various apps. So actually in the UI in iOS 8, Apple took all of their apps and sort of optimized them for the iPhone 6 Plus using the extra pixels and the extra space to display extra information. So they showed one example of contacts. So whereas contacts in, say, portrait mode on the iPhone 6, you have just your lists of names and you can kind of scroll through it. On the 6 Plus, there was enough extra resolution on the side that they could add little avatar icons for all of your contacts. And basically, you kind of get more of an iPad-like experience or an iPad-like mini experience in the UI on the iPhone 6 Plus. And so this was my first tinge just personally. You know, you all know that I have been berating and saying, I do not want a larger phone. I do not want a larger phone. But when I sort of saw these screenshots and saw that, well, if I get the iPhone 6, I'm going to be missing out on some UI things that are going to be able to be leveraged on the larger screen. That was my first pangs of, oh, well, maybe this won't be so bad. Maybe I can live with not being able to put my phone in my front jean pocket and figure out some other way. I don't know. What am I going to have to do? Maybe get a man purse or, God forbid, maybe we're bringing back fanny packs or just I need cargo pants or maybe a Scott E-vest. Is that cool? Utila kilts? I don't know. But, you know, your mind starts racing and you start wondering, hey, maybe I can make this work some way. Maybe just a leash that I sort of hang it off my belt or something like that. No, I don't know. I like having my iPhone in my front pocket. So you're going to find out throughout this episode that I'm really conflicted on whether I'm going to get the iPhone 6 or 6 Plus. As a matter of fact, Ars Technica has a place on their site, and maybe I'll link to it in the show notes at maccast.com, where you can go print out two-scale paper templates of the iPhone 6 and the iPhone 6 Plus. I've printed them out. I've been carrying these around for the past 24 hours, and I just keep picking them up and looking at them and going, wow, that iPhone 6 is giganta-huge, and I don't know if I'm really going to like it. But then at the same time, I see some of these cool things like extra UI enhancements and go, maybe I want more out of my iPhone, and if the only way to get it is the 6 Plus, maybe I can live with it. So I haven't made a decision. I've got about 24 hours, a little more, I guess 48 hours to decide, maybe less than that. And I'm sure you're going through the same sort of thing. So maybe together we can come up with a solution. But one thing that Apple threw out in terms of if you do go with a larger device, and this actually works on both the 6 and the 6 Plus, is, you know, you may not be able to stretch your thumb all the way up to the top of the user interface to get at some of the controls that are maybe at the top of the screen. So they've added in iOS 8 a reachability mode. Basically, what you do is you double touch, not tap or press, but just double touch the Touch ID button, and then the display slides down so that your thumb doesn't have to extend as far. So it basically just drops down below the fold. You get black on the top, and the top becomes a little bit easier to reach. I'm not so sure how I like it visually, but I get functionally this would work very well. I just question, again, because I have this paper template, how safe and secure my iPhone 6 Plus would be when I slide down to even just do the double touch motion, because you have to move your hand down to the bottom of the device. When I'm holding it normally in my hand the way I would, I can't stretch my thumb down. I'm not that flexible to even reach the home button. So I have to slide my hand down to the lower third of the 6 Plus, and at that point, all of the weight, two-thirds of it, is going to be sort of balancing on the top. So I almost feel like I'd have to squeeze the phone, and then I can't really slide my thumb. If I don't do that, I feel like it's going to topple over backwards, probably flip 180 and land flat on the face of the glass, which is not something you want. I don't know how strong Ion X glass is. I'm sure iFixit and some of the the websites are going to be testing that glass the minute the iPhone comes out. But it's, you know, it's not Sapphire, and so it better be really strong if Apple's going to be recommending that you use this gigantophone in one hand. I'm coming to the conclusion that if you go with a 6 Plus, I think it's really a two-handed device. I think despite Apple's best efforts and anything you might try and do, it's going to be safest and secure using it in two hands. The good news is that the phones are incredibly thin, 6.9 millimeters for the iPhone 6, 7.1 for the 6 Plus, and it does have the little camera wart, the camera bump, so Apple didn't put that inside. This is another area where I was a little bit disappointed, because how thin, really? How thin do we need it to be? Could they not have just made it? I think that camera bump is less than a millimeter thin, or just about a millimeter. Could we have had it be 1 millimeter thicker? And then Apple could have included more battery. Use the extra space for more battery. Everybody likes more battery. I think I'd opt for more battery and a flat flush back than actually having the little camera wart and having it be just, you know, a hair less than a millimeter thin. But regardless, very exciting new designs and sizes from Apple, and I look forward to actually seeing them in the flesh. Now let's get to some of the stuff on the inside, right? The nitty-gritty. Apple does have a new A8 processor. It's their second generation 64-bit architecture. 2 billion transistors in this thing, and it's built on 20-nanometer technology. So that lets them cram more transistors, more processing power into the chip, but still have it be 13% smaller, according to Phil Schiller. It's 25% faster in the CPU and up to 50% faster in GPU, so that means it's going to be able to process a lot more stuff. I have to wonder how much of that GPU increase is really going to be used just to drive the HD and specifically the larger display on the iPhone 6 Plus. So I don't know how much that will translate to in real world numbers, but we'll be getting those very, very shortly, as well as the different sites pull it in and run it through the speed tests and the benchmarks and things like that. But the chip is also able to be 50% more efficient. So that means that it has more sustained performance over time, so it can run longer. So that's another big thing for like high performance games and things like that. You want that processor to be running at full speed and not, you know, eating up all your battery, those sorts of things. So smaller, better graphics, more energy efficient, all good things. Apple also threw in a new motion coprocessor. So last year we got the M7. That's the thing that uses very little power to do things like track motion, keep track of the sensors, the gyroscope, all those sorts of things. And they added a couple new bits of functionality to the motion coprocessor. Now it can estimate distance. So if you're running, you're going places, it can kind of calculate how far you went, how far you ran, how far you drove, those sorts of things. And also they added a barometer, so now it can sense elevation. So this is going to be good for indoor mapping and positioning, also for exercise, doing stairs, those sorts of things. They're going to be able to include that kind of technology. And we had kind of seen that in the leaks, that it had this new barometer in there. So that is now confirmed that is part of the M8 or the sensor architecture, and will integrate with the M8 motion coprocessor. Battery life, Apple set the target, as they always do, to kind of get equal or better battery life than the iPhone 5S. And it turns out in the iPhone 6, they were able to get a little bit better battery life. And it makes sense because, again, they're a little bit larger. Apple can cram a little bit more battery in there. So on the iPhone 6, they're saying you're going to get 50 hours of audio, 11 hours of video, 11 hours of Wi-Fi browsing, 10 hours of LTE browsing, and 14 hours of talk time. Now, what's really impressive is the battery numbers for the iPhone 6 Plus. You're going to get 80 hours of audio, 14 hours of video, 12 hours of Wi-Fi and LTE browsing, and up to 24 hours of talk time. So that's almost double talk time and 30 hours more of audio time, 3 hours more of video. So pretty significant in terms of the battery improvement. And that was sort of the second thing, the second point that hit me that went, oh, maybe I do want the bigger phone for some of these technical aspects. Longer battery life, I rely on and use my phone a lot, and I have had those days where I run out of juice. And so if it can deliver better battery performance, and this is something, you know, people who have always been in the gigantophone camp, those people who love, and I'll just say the word because people, people know what this is, people that have Android phablets, That's one of the things they talk about is I have this great long battery life. So that is somewhat appealing. And another thing that's appealing is something that's new in the camera. Let's talk about the cameras a little bit. 8-megapixel EyeSight camera. So same number of megapixels, but they have tweaked the sensor. So we have a new sensor, 1.5 micron pixels, an aperture of 2.2, and there is that new round True Tone flash. So no longer the little oblong thing. You actually have a little round one, and that was another thing we saw in the leaks. True Tone flash is the thing that sort of helps balance out the flash so you didn't get that color shift. We had that in the iPhone 5S. It's continuing in the new model. But there's a new sensor also built in with something Apple is calling focus pixels. Remember what I said about the marketing term? So focus pixels, what that basically translates down to for us is it means the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus are going to be able to focus faster. The pixels actually have little shutters in them, a dedicated pair of shutters, and they use something called phase detection autofocus, which I guess is a feature in higher-end digital SLR cameras. So Apple bringing sort of higher-end technology down into this small package. It just means it can focus really, really quickly. They also have local tone mapping in the sensors as well as advanced noise reduction. So they're able to do a lot more processing and kind of make your pictures look better, right? And that's what we all really want. Panoramas can now be up to 43 megapixels, so you can do huge, beautiful panoramas. And they have a new dedicated signal processor in the A8 chip. So this is the thing that's going to actually take all your images and be able to process them. It's what enables that that sort of fast face detection. And face detection is now faster. It also has more advanced blink and smile detection. That's for your burst photos. So when you take a burst photo on your iPhone, it analyzes the image and it tries to pull out the best images. So I guess the new sensor is going to be able to do, or the new signal processor is going to be able to do a better job at that. And then came that thing that I was hoping wouldn't happen. The iPhone 6 Plus and the iPhone 6 Plus only has optical image stabilization in the camera. So that means that if you're shaky and you're moving around, it's going to use the gyroscope and it'll actually be able to compensate the lens and sort of counteract any of that movement. And that's going to be good for longer exposure photos. So when you're shooting in low light or shooting at night, those images are going to come out better on an iPhone 6 Plus. And like I said, that's something that is appealing to me, even though I don't think I take that many photos, but it'd just be a nice feature to have, and it's exclusive to the larger phone. Now, not exclusive to the larger phone is some of the video updates as well as FaceTime HD camera updates. So on the video side, 1080p HD video, which we had before, but we shot that at 30 frames per second on the iPhone 5S. You can now shoot at 60 frames per second. It also has continual autofocus, so no longer having to tap to refocus when you move from a close object to a further away object. It's going to handle that all automatically for you. Cinematic video stabilization. So this is almost like real-time Steadicam kind of stuff. So if you're running with the phone or you're riding a bike while trying to shoot something else, I don't know why you would do that, but Apple showed that in one of their example videos, which is why I thought about that. But, you know, they had someone who was riding mountain bike and someone was riding along next to them sort of shooting video, and it was completely stabilized, and they're doing that, it looks like, in the image processing in the hardware chips, which is going to be much faster and much better quality. You can also now get super slow motion video, 240 frames per second, as opposed to the 120 frames per second we have now. And then iOS 8 is bringing that new time-lapse feature, so you'll be able to take time-lapse photography as well with the camera. And then when we turn around and get to the front-facing camera, that FaceTime HD camera, they're using an all-new sensor there. It has a larger aperture, again, an f2.2. It's going to allow 81% more light, which means better quality and better face detection. They have a new burst mode there, so you actually can take burst mode photos with the FaceTime camera now. And single shot, what they're calling single shot HDR. So those of you who know high dynamic range photography, basically the way that works is you take multiple different exposures normally. You would take multiple different exposures and then sort of combine them together. Apparently, they figured out some way to do that in a single photo, a single exposure, but still get that large dynamic range so that you have your background and your foreground and your midground all with a lot of detail and color and those sorts of things. So those are the improvements on the camera system. Then they talked a little bit about wireless functionality, improved wireless, faster LTE, up to 150 megabits per second. Of course, that's going to depend on carrier support. They've added more LTE bands to the chip, which makes it even more of a world phone. So if you're the type of person who is traveling globally and needing to swap SIMs, they now support 20 different LTE bands. Apple claimed that's more than any other phone that's out on the market. They talked a little bit about voice over LTE that lets you make voice phone calls over the LTE data network. That also is going to require carrier support, although they did say they have support from most of their carrier partners at this point. At least it looked like in the U.S. and maybe some other countries. 802.11ac, so the faster 802.11 is on the new iPhones. That was something I thought, you know, I was on the fence with. I didn't know if Apple would add that because it does have a little bit more of a power requirement. But I guess, you know, next generation 802.11, they want that in there, and that is in there. And then they talked about Wi-Fi calling. This is the ability to make telephone calls over your Wi-Fi through the cellular carrier networks. So you're using Wi-Fi versus cellular. So if you're in an area where maybe you don't have the best cell coverage, but you do have Wi-Fi available, you're going to be able to make your calls. That, again, is going to require carrier support. And at launch, Apple said they're only going to have T-Mobile in the U.S. and EE in the U.K., maybe the whole EU. I don't remember, and I didn't specifically put it in my notes, so I'm sorry about that. You're going to have to double-check me on that one. But T-Mobile and EE are going to be supporting the Wi-Fi calling. So that's great. That's all the cool new stuff that's in the new iPhones. When can we get them? What sizes, configurations, are options? Apple did do that interesting thing that we had heard about and was speculated that they were going to drop the 32-gigabyte option and go with 16, 64, and 128. Why they would drop the 32 and go with a 16, I'm not entirely sure. I guess maybe to keep the cost down and the margins up, but you'll be able to get a iPhone 6, that's the 4.7-inch display, starting at $199 for 16 gigabytes, $299 for 64 gigabytes, and $399 US for 128 gigabytes. The iPhone 6 Plus is going to be $100 more across the board, so you're going to be paying $100 more for that larger screen, the image-stabilized camera, the better battery life. So those are coming in at $299 US for 16 gigabytes, $399 for 64 gigabytes, and $499 for 128 gigabytes. So I thought that pricing was actually pretty good, very aggressive, starting at $199 on the iPhone 6. And then they are going to continue to sell the iPhone 5S at $99, and then the iPhone 5C in an 8-gigabyte version is going to be available on contract for free. And I should mention that all the prices I'm quoting are on contract prices. I didn't see and haven't found any of the off contract prices yet, but you can imagine they're going to be a lot more expensive than those prices. It is going to be shipping on September 19th, and you're going to be able to pre-order them this Friday on the 12th. Well, depending upon when you're listening to this podcast. So Friday the 12th, they do go on pre-order, and that's going to be in the US and 8 other countries: Canada, UK, France, Germany, Australia, Hong Kong, Singapore, and Japan. And then Apple said they're going to have their most aggressive international rollout ever, or they're shooting for that. They're hoping to have 115 countries with the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus by the end of 2014. So if you're not in the launch countries, the ones that are coming out on the 19th, you should have iPhones in your area before, new iPhones in your area before the end of the year. And then they also gave a little update on when iOS 8 was shipping. They shipped the Gold Masters out to developers yesterday, on Tuesday, and they're going to be shipping iOS 8 to everyone on September 17th. So if you've been waiting to upgrade, that's when you're going to be able to do it. So that was everything on the iPhone 6S. I'm super excited to be buying one. I have no idea which model I'm going to choose, as I mentioned earlier. At this exact moment, I'm kind of leaning toward the 6 Plus. And I have to tell you, it's this podcast that talked me into it, because this morning I was thinking iPhone 6. And I'm sure I'm going to be waffling back and forth until I actually press the order button at midnight on Friday. But stay tuned. I'll update you on Twitter or something on the one I actually end up purchasing. Maybe I'll just buy both and then sell the one that I don't want. It's one of the dilemmas you're in when you're like myself, and I want to be able to cover this for you, get my hands on it as soon as possible so I can talk to you about it. And I do want to pre-order, so I make sure that I have the phone day one. If I could wait, I probably would want to actually just go into a retail store and actually touch and feel and hold both of them to kind of make that final decision. But I don't think I'm going to have that luxury. And actually, a lot of us might not have that luxury, because I have this feeling, especially on the 5.5-inch model, it's still sounding like they're going to be in very short supply and quantity. So you're going to want to, if you want one of these phones, you're going to want to get your order in. You're going to get to an Apple store on the 19th, very, very early, maybe the night before, to try and pick one up. You know, it's going to be the typical thing where everybody's going to want these things and they're going to go really, really quick. So I kind of have to make my choice now if I want to make sure that I get one in my hand. So maybe the thing is order two and then figure out what I'm going to do with one or the other later. Maybe the best tactic, especially if they're in short supply, I might not do too bad when I turn around and maybe have to resell one of them. But that's iPhone 6. And that was just the first big announcement that Apple had. Then we heard about their payment system. We knew this was rumored. And of course, I turned out to be completely wrong. It's not based on iBeacon and low energy Bluetooth. It is NFC, near field communication technology. It is a touch to pay system. It does take advantage and use Touch ID for security, which is cool because there's no need to wake your iPhone to actually use the system. The sensor, the NFC sensor, is built across the top of your phone. So what you'll do is you'll take your phone out, you'll tap it to the little payment terminal. It will wake up the phone, ask you for your fingerprint using the Touch ID sensor, and that's it. Then you can pay. And I have to admit, in seeing the demo, it does look pretty cool. And I think the key is the user experience, right? That user experience that I just described to you right there is so simple. It has to be infinitely different than what we do today, which is, you know, take out your wallet, find the card that you want to pay with, swipe the card, hope that the card swiper and the magnetic reader work and you're not doing it multiple times, handing your ID to the clerk. When you hand the card over, especially at a restaurant or something like that, there's a security issue because your card number is exposed. Even the, you know, quote unquote security number on the back is exposed. So if you notice with the Touch ID, with the Apple Pay process, rather, it takes all of that away, right? You're just taking out your phone, you're tapping, you're using your fingerprint, no ID, no numbers are exchanged, none of that. The disadvantage here, and I think this is a significant one, and I think it was not necessarily downplayed, but nobody's really talking about this, is it means you have to have new hardware in order to be able to use the system. So that limits immediately the number of people that are going to be able to take advantage of the system. And I just felt that if Apple could have built it on top of low energy Bluetooth, something that's built in millions of iPhones that are already out there in the market, they would have a much more rapid adoption of the system by consumers. As it stands now, you're going to have to buy a new device to be able to actually take advantage of the payment system. You know, It's a short-term problem. I think long-term people are going to be upgrading and they're going to get the new technology when they upgrade their Apple devices. But it is something to be considered. So it was just an interesting choice because I don't know that it had to rely on an NFC chip. As far as security goes, Apple has what they call their own secure element chip in the iPhone 6. So it sounds like another dedicated chip, probably very secure, very similar to the secure enclave. I don't know if it's a separate chip on the board or something that's built into the A8 processor. They didn't specifically mention that, although in their little image that they showed during the keynote, it looked like it was a chip just on the board. But it is going to securely store and encrypt the information for the payment system in there. And they don't actually store credit card numbers or any credit card information. They don't store the security code off of the card. They actually use a one-time use device-only account number. So they randomly generate account numbers for the payments as well as dynamic security codes, and that's what's stored in there. And they never store credit card numbers. They never give any of the information to the merchants. So it was obvious when they were presenting this that security and privacy were really big things, in the system as well. And again, this goes back to the whole user experience. You don't want the kind of situation where you lose your phone. It's just like losing your wallet. You have to now call up and cancel all your credit cards and deal with that whole rigmarole. They've got a bunch of protections in place to make sure that that doesn't happen. Your credit cards, after you put them into the system, are stored in Passbook. But again, they don't have any numbers or any information on there. It's your name, and that's about it. I think there's a partial credit card number, that sort of thing. And when you put a card in the system, it actually has to get verified with your bank that it's your card in order to be added to the system. But then once it's in there, it's never stored, it's never used. They're using this tokenization system to actually control that protection. And not only that, with Find My iPhone, it's linked into that. If you can use Find My iPhone, if you lose your iPhone, to actually just disable payments on the device. So you can just turn off the payment system to make sure no one can use your phone to actually buy anything. Not that they could anyway, because they're still going to need your fingerprint. So there's just multiple mechanisms to kind of protect that data. Another thing that's in there is privacy. Apple made a very big point of pointing out that they're not going to track what you buy, where you buy it, how much you spent on things. The merchant potentially could. The card issuing bank potentially could. You would know that information, but Apple's not involved in that part of the transaction at all. And again, there's no exposure of your name, your number, or security code in the transaction. They did have really big carrier support. And I think this is another, merchant bank and credit card company support, as well as retailer support for the system. So a lot of people were wondering, why has it taken Apple so long to get into this mobile payments game? We've seen Google go in very heavily. You've got other systems like Square, some of the other payment platforms that are out there that are using mobile devices and seem really innovative. It seems like Apple was taking their time over the last couple of years to make sure that they had deals in place. So they have support from the three major credit card companies in the U.S., Amex, MasterCard, and Visa. They have support from most of the major card issuing banks. I think they said it covers up to 83% of the banks in the U.S. are on board with Apple's new system. They're going to support out of the gate 220,000 retail locations that can accept contactless payments. And I've been having a debate with some people about this number. Eddie Q came out and said that. I think we mean this is existing contactless payment systems from that support Amex, MasterCard, and Visa that are already at retail locations, because they also announced support from some other retailers, Macy's and Bloomberg's, Walgreens, Duane Reade, Staples, Petco, Toys R Us and Babies R Us, Nike, Sephora, Subway, McDonald's, Panera, Whole Foods, Apple retail stores, and Disney are all going to be supporting Apple Pay. But I think even all those companies together wouldn't add up to 220,000 payment terminals. So I think a lot of the systems that are already out there are going to be supported. And that may be one of the reasons why they went with the NFC technology, because it was already widely deployed and they're able to take advantage of that. And several of you pointed that out to me when I was making my case for Apple not using NFC. And, you know, as I kind of felt, I kind of felt like, especially in the late stages of this thing, I wasn't going to be right. And that turned out to be absolutely the case. But the system seems really slick and cool. I think at this point now, it's going to be all down to how much do consumers adopt it? How much do retailers adopt it? And Apple does have some leverage in this area with, you know, it being tied into iTunes. That's another one of the cool things, is when you first set it up, if you already have your iTunes card on file, you can set that up immediately to be your default card. So once Apple Pay comes out, which is going to be available next month, so it's going to be an upgrade to iOS 8, and they are going to support the iPhone 6 and 6 Plus, because you do need to have the NFC chip in your iPhone. You're not going to be able to do it on older devices. And I think that will slow the adoption rate a little bit, but maybe there'll be some other solutions for that sort of thing. And then, I almost forgot, they also are going to integrate this into online payments, or look more specifically to me like in-app payments. So if a retailer has an app, they're going to be able to add an Apple Pay button to give one-touch checkout in their app, and maybe one-touch checkout on their websites as well. Basically, you'll have a little Pay with Apple Pay button, and clicking that, you won't have to give a credit card number or an address, a shipping address, because it's going to have that on file with your Apple account. No credit card info given to the merchant, and a couple of different companies are going to be supporting the online Apple Pay: Target, Groupon, Uber, Panera, MLB.com, the Apple Store, and even OpenTable, which they typically don't take credit cards. But if you make a reservation through OpenTable and then have your meal, you're going to be able to pay through the OpenTable app using Apple Pay. So that's pretty cool. So they've got some major players on board. These are some big companies, some high-profile companies saying they're going to support Apple Pay. And I think as more and more people go into retail locations and say, hey, can I pay with Apple Pay? And then they say no, they're going to see that, hey, there's a high demand for this. And anytime there's a high demand for something, that's going to very much speed adoption. So Apple is going to have a pretty nice system on their hands, and I think it's going to be picked up by a lot of people. A couple of additional details just to point out, some stuff that didn't come out during the presentation. I already mentioned that you can use your card that's already registered to your iTunes account, to your Apple ID. If you register multiple cards or input multiple cards into the system, oh, and I should mention, to add additional cards. So if you go with the card that's already on file on iTunes, it'll be automatically added in there. If you want to add additional cards, you actually just take your card out, take a picture with the EyeSight camera within, I would assume, Passbook to kind of add the card, and it will automatically analyze, check with your bank to make sure that it's your card, and then add it to your Passbook account, put it right in there. So then when you're paying, when you come up, like I said, you can take your phone out. It doesn't even have to be awake. You touch it to the terminal. It will wake up and then show you your default card. But then you can also just tap at the bottom to swipe up and get to your additional cards. So you can select a different card at that point and then pay again by pressing your touch ID, your fingerprint to the Touch ID sensor. But that Touch ID element is another key part of why Apple's NFC system might be a little bit better than what's already out there. I guess currently a lot of the touchless payment systems have limitations on the amount of the transaction. So usually between $25 to $50 US is the limit. If you go over that, you actually have to do the swipe or the chip and pin if you're in another country. You have to use some sort of other method. You can't just use the whole tap to pay system. And that's actually a security feature, because if your card were to get stolen and there was no limit like that, someone could just go around without ID, without anything, and tap and pay for all kinds of stuff and run up your card. Well, because Apple has Touch ID and you've got that fingerprint sensor, that with Apple system means that you can't pay without being you. Even if you had the device, even if you had the credit card there in the iPhone, you're not going to be able to use it. So those transaction limits, this hasn't been confirmed, but the suspicion is that you'll be able to get past those transaction limits because of this. And again, that changes that user experience, right? It makes it much easier to make purchases at a retail location with just your phone and not having to give out a bunch of other information. And so then you might be wondering, well, how does Apple make any money off of this? You know, maybe it drives iPhone sales, iPhone 6 sales, because you want to be able to use Apple Pay, but probably not for a lot of people. Most people are just going to go with their natural upgrade cycle and get that whenever. Well, according to Bloomberg, it's looking like Apple is going to collect a fee from actually the banks, the card issuing banks. So every time Apple Pay is used, the banks are going to give them a little bit. Those banks already collect a fee, so it would be, I would assume, some percentage of the fee that they get. And like I said, Apple has struck deals with each of the banks that they've partnered with, so JPMorgan Chase, Bank of America, Citigroup, a bunch of others, and so they might be paying just a little bit to Apple every time the system is used. And banks make over $40 billion annually in the fees, the swipe fees. So if Apple gets just 1% of that, I think that works out to like $400 million for Apple's bottom line. Of course, they're not going to get every transaction to go over to Apple Pay, but you can see right away where just, you know, a small percentage of that transaction fee, and Apple could be doing a pretty good business with their Apple Pay system. And then the side benefit is people are going to want to use it. They're going to want to get iOS devices or Apple Pay devices that can use Apple Pay, and it will generate more sales as well. So there's kind of a two-pronged approach, at least, to Apple making some revenue from this thing, and that's always, always a good thing. So that's kind of the Apple Pay system. I'm personally very excited about being able to use the system. Again, I just hope that it's not going to be the kind of case that I've had with a lot of the NFC systems to date, where I go in, I ask a retailer if I can pay with my you know, tap to pay, and they tell me, no, you can't use the system. Even though I can see it right there on the terminal, I have the logo on my card, you know, they'll give me some excuse, it doesn't work. I think they just don't like it. So hopefully this is a system with the Apple brand behind it that people trust and are encouraged to use, and hopefully rapid deployment makes it ubiquitous, because that's really the key. You need to be able to use it everywhere. That's why credit cards and the swipe system or the chip and pin system like they have overseas, you can use it everywhere. You're never like turned down. It's like, yeah, you've got the card, use it. So hopefully it'll be, yeah, you've got the iPhone, use the Apple Pay. And then came something, some words in the keynote that we had not heard in a while. Tim Cook, borrowing from Steve Jobs, gave us "and one more thing." And I think it was no surprise that one more thing was the not iWatch. This was surprising. Not iWatch, Apple Watch. And you notice we have Apple Pay, Apple Watch. So something that's being talked about, and I think this is significant and worth mentioning, is that Apple seems to be moving away from the iBranding. And I thought this made perfect sense for the current Apple. Apple is moving into more consumer space sort of stuff. The iBrand, which Steve Jobs, I think, invented with the, and Apple, I don't know if it's specifically only credited to Steve Jobs, but when Steve Jobs came back and announced the iMac, that was where it all started, right? We had iMac, and the thing was, is I stood for internet. And back in the 90s, when this was all going down, that made a lot of sense, right? Internet was like a big deal. Now it's sort of like it's a prerequisite for anything in technology. So I think it's time to kind of start shedding the I moniker. And Apple, the Apple moniker really reinforces the brand. And Apple has built up, you know, such a brand over the years. It's widely recognized. So I think leveraging that makes a lot of sense. So I think that's part of the reason why we ended up with Apple Pay and Apple Watch. And I actually like Apple Watch, I think, better than iWatch, although everybody seems to be slipping up, including Tim Cook. I guess he gave an ABC interview and actually said iWatch, sort of confirming that at one point this was considered to be the iWatch, but at some point they switched it. And it may be because there was some threats of potential lawsuits from Swatch, which I think had an iSwatch or something like that, and they were worried that there was going to be some sort of market confusion there, and they had a trademark on it, so they were going to potentially enforce that. So Apple just got around it, went with Apple Watch, and I think it's a much better branding. But we'd all been waiting on this, and you know, I think a lot of folks in the smartwatch space who've been trying to sort of rush and beat Apple to the punch, Apple showed it didn't really matter what they did. They were not going to be able to match what Apple was able to do. And we know that because Apple has spent years, and we kind of watched it through the rumor mill, building up this incredible team in all areas, not just technology, right? Too many of Apple's competitors are going the technology route. They're straight technology companies. They're looking at all the whiz-bang stuff they can do. But what they're missing out on is the materials, the user experience, the sort of history. I was very impressed by the amount of thought Apple put into the history of timekeeping. They even used a term, horology, and they didn't really explain that. It's basically the study of time. It's the people who are in that industry, right? They got people from watchmakers and fashion designers and, you know, artists and technical people. It was a full combined team of skills that went into building this thing, and it really shows in the final product. And this is what Apple is so great at and what Apple's competitors really don't get, right? And it goes back to Apple's roots. Again, it was very appropriate that they were in the Flint Center where the Mac was launched, because Steve Jobs had such a passion for typography and calligraphy, sort of the basis for fonts. And that's why the Mac had such a great font system and then went into desktop publishing, because it even though it was a new piece of technology, it had that history, it had that lineage. And the iWatch has that same sort of stuff. It has its roots, even though it's a brand new product, in a lot of these old disciplines and also existing sort of cultures, right? The fashion culture, which this is a big deal. This is something you're going to wear every day. It has to look good. And we can debate the merits on whether it looks good or not. I think it's one of the better looking smartwatch designs that we've seen out there. I think the Moto 360 and the Apple Watch are probably the two best looking devices out there right now. And I'm not sure which one has the edge. So they both kind of have, I think, their advantages. But Apple did a fantastic job with the design and the styling. And then more so the materials. Like, this is jewelry quality materials and metals. They worked with metallurgy and, you know, people to make sure they had the right materials. And this is what's going to make the difference when a consumer is comparing one or the other, right? When they're deciding to spend the kind of money that these things cost, and we'll talk about pricing here in a little bit, that's what's going to make the difference, especially when you're getting into this whole jewelry side of things. So let's talk a little bit about sizes and technology and those sorts of things, the nitty-gritty, the specs. So Apple built a whole new custom processor for this, and it's not just a processor. It's actually an entire computer in a single chip. All the processing, all the subsystems in this funky-shaped, custom, completely sealed in resin chip. They're calling it the Apple S1, kind of the brains of the whole operation, does everything. It powers the iPhone. We don't know, or the iPhone, the Apple Watch. We don't know a lot of the details in terms of memory and processing speed and all those sorts of things. That's going to be coming later, I would imagine. But they have that in there. They have a new sensor. So they didn't just throw a vibration sensor like you'd find on your iPhone in there, because, you know, those things buzz, they're loud. I actually have a Pebble, and it's a little bit annoying because you can actually hear every time it goes off, you know, sort of buzzing and shaking, and it's a weird sensation on your wrist. They built a little haptic feedback sensor. They're calling it the Apple Taptic Feedback, and it's supposed to be a lot more subtle. They describe it as sort of someone just sort of tapping you on the wrist. And I guess you can actually kind of feel different sorts of taps. And they actually have a new communication system where you can kind of tap another person from watch to watch, and they'll be able to feel it. And then you can draw little illustrations and things like that. It's really kind of interesting. They call it sort of intimate communication. It feels a little bit gimmicky. You know, I slam Android and some of the other devices for having little gimmicky things. This one feels gimmicky until I've actually used it and experienced it. I don't know. Maybe people will really like it. It definitely adds a human touch. And this is another thing that Apple does a lot to their products, right? They think about the people behind the technology, not just the technology itself, but who's going to use this? How are they going to use it? And more importantly, how are you going to have a connection with the technology, or more importantly, how's the technology going to get out of the way so you can make connections with other people or connections with the projects you're working on, those sorts of things. They think that stuff through. As far as charging, it does use induction charging, and it has kind of this cool MagSafe connector that just locks into the back plate of the phone. And there's some really cool sensor technology on the back of the watch. I just said phone again. Sorry about that. The watch. It connects into the watch and does the charging, and then they have sensors on the back. So they have heart rate sensors built in, so you can actually measure your heart rate, and that just sits right there, your pulse rate, on your wrist. And I thought, you know, the back of that looks very watch-like. It looks like, you know, normally where the battery compartment would be. So there's certainly, when you're looking at it, you know immediately this is a watch. They thought about the user interface. And, you know, with a very small screen, if it's a touch screen, you really don't want to have to touch these little elements necessarily on the screen all the time, because it covers the display as you actually touch. So taking cues from watch designs, you know, the little winder, which I guess is called a crown in the watch circles, one thing that Apple learned from, you know, talking to and working with watch people, is they created what they're calling a digital crown, a digital version of that. Although it's I don't know why they call it a digital crown. I guess maybe because it controls the digital display, but it's very much a physical and analog sort of button. You twist it and you can do different actions, like scrolling through things forward and backward or zooming in and out. And this makes a lot of sense, because now you're not touching to zoom in, and pinch to zoom really on that small of a display would never really work. I think the Android devices do try to do it, but doesn't make a whole lot of sense. So this little kind of scroll wheel, the little digital crown, is genius. And it's the kind of thing that you expect Apple to do, but you're still surprised when you actually see it. And there was a lot of concern with the crown, because it's on the upper right hand corner of the watch. If you're right-handed, people were like, well, what about left-handed people? You know, this isn't going to work. You're going to have to kind of reach across the watch face. You can actually just flip it around. The bands, straps that come are interchangeable. They slide in and out, and they've got a bunch of design stylings there. So you can actually just flip it around. Left-handed people are going to have the crown on the bottom left instead of the top right, but I don't think that really changes the UI too much. And then you can just flip the display around. There's a little button, flip it 180, and now it's a left-handed Apple Watch. It does come in two sizes, 38 millimeter and 42 millimeter. Both look a little large from some of the hands-on area shots that I've seen. They do seem a little big, and a bunch of the reviews mention that, you know, when you visually look at it, they do look a little bit large, but then they say once you have it on your wrist, it's a lot lighter than you'd expect, and it doesn't feel or look all that big. So Apple, I think, kind of nailed the sizing on this. It, of course, could always be a little bit smaller, but I think if you get too small, then it's going to be hard to read different things on this the display. So I think there was a little bit of trade-off maybe having to go on there. Apple is, you know, again, going back to the fashion stuff, they were really concerned about the design and the customization. And this thing is very customizable. So they have a bunch of different materials and finishes for the watch itself. And then they have six different strap designs or styles that are completely interchangeable. So you can get different watches and things like that. Out of the gate, they mentioned they're going to have what they're calling three collections. There's going to be the Apple Watch collection, the Apple Watch Sport, and the Apple Watch Edition. So the Apple Watch is kind of your basic Apple Watch. They've got some leather straps, some metal link straps, some polymer straps, basically, you know, plastic kind of straps. And then the Sports Edition is all plastic. The one difference on the Sports Edition is they're using Ion X glass instead of sapphire glass. I should mention, this is the first time we heard Apple talk about sapphire glass was with the Apple Watch. The Apple Watch and the Apple Watch Edition both do have sapphire glass glass fronts or glass displays. So that's a difference there. And then the Apple Watch Edition is the big difference there, in addition to the glass, is the metal on the casing is actually 18 karat gold. And they have a gold color and a rose gold color there. So I would fully expect those, the Apple Watch Edition, to be quite a bit pricier than probably the Apple Watch or the Apple Sport. Other than that, the tech specs are pretty much the same across the entire lineup in terms of processor, memory, resolution. Really, the differences are in the style, the finish, the glass, those sorts of things. So more aesthetic kinds of things. And of course, you got the two device sizes, so there's a little bit different there. But you can get any of the editions in any of the sizes with bands that are adjusted accordingly. And Apple has been working on this, obviously, for a very long time. The one thing is that an iPhone is required. You do have to have an iPhone to work with the iWatch. Sounding like it doesn't have any kind of communication built into the watch other than probably Bluetooth to communicate with your phone. So no built-in Wi-Fi, no cellular data stuff. It's not really clear if any functions will work on the watch. I would, without an iPhone connection, I'm assuming you're going to be able to get some basic functionality, but if you need to do anything that's internet related or get communication from another app, that sort of thing. And they are going to have apps on the phone, so you would think there's some amount of memory in there, there's some amount of processing power, so maybe some simple apps, kind of widget sorts of apps and stuff like that. So that's kind of the hardware and the technology styling. Then you've got the operating system, right? You've got this teeny tiny screen, so there's some different interactions and ways you need to be able to use the device and operate. And once again, Apple really thought this stuff through. The app launcher, this one I'm going to have to play around with to see how it really works. David Pogue pointed out that none of the apps have any sorts of labels. So if you don't recognize the icon, because what you've got is this little sort of array of circles. And Apple says they can be broken down into little classifications or neighborhoods. You can, you know, move them around on the device and organize them the way that you want. So maybe you can group them into little categories. But again, there's no folder labels that I was able to see. There's no sort of category labels. There's no app labels. So you kind of pan and zoom around and then zoom into a neighborhood and then you can zoom down to maybe an app. What I'm hoping, and I didn't see this on any of the actual demos, is that when you get down into the single app mode, that maybe a label comes up at that point. So it may take a little getting used to, but visually it looks really, really cool. And I guess I should have mentioned it is a square display and not a round display like the Moto 360, in case you haven't seen it. But you can go into the different application neighborhoods. You can launch applications. You have your typical swipe, double tap gestures, tap gestures. But there's also a new gesture, something Apple is calling force touch. So the display actually can detect a more forceful push on something. And it looks like typically a force touch will allow you to go into settings for different applications or for the springboard itself. So if you're in the main display, you can force click and it will bring up options. If you're within an app or some sort of settings, you can force tap or force touch and get into those. There's something called glances. These feel very much like control center. Same kind of gesture, swipe up from the bottom, and then you get a little card kind of interface, what Apple's calling their glance interface, so you can get different information like weather, sports scores, or stock information, and you can swipe through the different glances and get information. There is going to be music controls in there. You can control music from an iPhone or a Mac, they mentioned, so there's definitely going to be some Mac integration and control with the Apple Watch. And also, they said you could listen to music on the watch itself, which says to me it's going to have some amount of storage. You're going to be able to actually get some music on there. What wasn't clear is how would you listen? There is, you know, a little tiny speaker because it does make noise in it, but there's no headphone jack. So I would assume through the Bluetooth, but Apple doesn't currently sell any Bluetooth headphones. So maybe out of the Beats acquisition, we're going to get some Beats Bluetooth headphones that are going to actually work with your Apple Watch. I think it's no surprise that one of the big applications for an Apple Watch is going to be being able to get notifications, but not just one-way notifications. You're going to actually be able to interact in some different ways and some very thoughtful ways with notifications. A couple things that are going to happen with notifications: it takes advantage of that Taptic engine and the Taptic sensor, so you're going to be able to actually feel the notification when it comes in. The watch display actually doesn't come on until you actually raise your wrist. So when you're just sitting there, it's not going to be distracting to other people around you. I'm assuming this is also to save a little bit on the battery life. But the minute you raise your wrist, you'll be able to see your incoming notifications. So you'll feel it first, raise your wrist, be able to see it. And then Apple's going to offer what they call quick board replies. So contextually, it's going to figure out, okay, what kind of notification is this? Is it a tweet? Is it a message? And it's going to offer some real quick ways to sort of send a reply by default. And it analyzes the text of even like your text message to kind of determine what a typical reply might be for that text. And it breaks that out for you and just gives you buttons that you can press. Then, of course, you can tap, you know, to do it custom, but with no sort of keyboard or keyboard input, you might be wondering what you would do. So in the case of a message, you can actually do dictation and send a voice text back, or you can also have it translate, do voice to text or speech to text translations. So just like on your iPhone with text dictation. And they also have animated emoji. So you can actually send emoji icons that are animated, and they showed that off a little bit too. And they look pretty nice. To me, emoji's always a little bit gimmicky, but maybe going watch to watch, it makes a lot more sense because you have a more visual form of communication on a much smaller screen. Siri is built in, which was exciting to hear. So you actually can do Siri style queries. You can ask for directions. You can have her look up contacts, play music, all those sorts of things. The one thing I did notice is, though, while you get the familiar Siri, you know, dinging sound, there is no voice. At least I didn't see or hear in the demo Siri's voice. So it's sort of Siri, silent Siri, which was a little bit odd. It was a little bit weird, but it did work. They had a nice visualization for when you were talking, that sort of thing. So I'll be excited to play around with that when the watch comes out. There is a Photos app, so you can use the little digital crown to zoom into photos. I think this is going to be a lot like it felt on your iPod screen, or even like if you had an iPod Nano with photos on it. It's not really, really useful, but nice little feature to have in there. Maps is built in. You can get directions. One really interesting thing about the map directions, specifically if you're doing walking directions, I think this is going to be really useful, or maybe even driving in the car. You can get Taptic feedback for each turn, and they said you'll get different sort of touches for the turns. So when you need to turn left or right, and you'll be able to tell the difference when it's coming up, which way you're going to be turning. And that's kind of a big deal, I think, also for something like accessibility. So somebody who's visually impaired could really take advantage of the taptic feedback in the directions to kind of figure out where they're going and know where they're at and those sorts of things. So interesting, interesting technology. And I think that's what Apple means by sort of it being really personal, right? You've got this device that actually is, sounds a little bit creepy when I say it this way now too, though. It's actually touching you in a very specific and controlled way. So that's okay. So you got the, and speaking of that, Apple leveraged that for a messaging system as well. They're having something they're calling Taptic Messages using digital touch. And it's accessed, there's a little button on the side of the watch just below the crown. And when you press that, it goes into the Taptic Messaging app. And that lets you draw little images on the screen that you can send to somebody. You can actually send someone touches. And you can even send your actual heartbeat as it's read through the heartbeat sensor on the watch. You can send that to somebody and then they'll actually feel it as touch. So that's the little gimmicky thing that they have. It'll be interesting to see how useful that is or if it can be leveraged by sort of third-party apps to do new and interesting things. And I'm sure that sort of thing is going to happen. And speaking of third-party apps, they are going to be able to take advantage of a lot of stuff in the iWatch. Specifically, notifications, they said, are going to kind of work in a default mode. So any app that can do notifications on your phone is going to be able to send notifications to the Apple Watch. And then there's a developer kit, a watch kit, that will allow developers to further enhance and leverage that experience. So they can create actionable notifications. So that's the thing where you're going to be able to actually reply or interact with notifications on the Apple Watch. They'll be able to add their apps to the home screen, and they'll be able to create their own custom glimpses, the little notification style cards that you can bring up with additional information related to the app. And Apple gave some examples of some of the third-party integrations that are kind of happening already. They mentioned Starwood Hotels, the W Hotels. You're going to be able to check into your hotel room with your watch, as well as unlock your hotel room door. Honeywell has a thermostat that you're going to be able to control from the watch. Lutron, which makes lights, they'll be able to do that. I'm assuming that integrates and works through Apple's HomeKit system, but they didn't talk at all about HomeKit, and I thought that would be prime for the iWatch that, you know, or Apple Watch. See, I just did it. I think hopefully that was my first slip up in this episode. You may have caught another one. I wouldn't be surprised. But yeah, they didn't talk about HomeKit at all, which was really surprising because I think that's a perfect application for the iWatch. Apps will be able to be loaded directly from your iPhone, so you're not going to have to connect to a Mac or anything else like that. And there is going to be a Ping My iPhone app. So if you have your watch and you don't know where your iPhone is, obviously they need to work together. So if you need to be able to find it, you'll be able to hit that and it will send an alert and make your iPhone actually play a sound. I'm assuming it's like a local version almost of Find My iPhone. So as you can see, Apple has given a lot of thought and detail, as they do, to the software, the user interface, how it's going to interact, those sorts of things. Now, they kind of broke the Apple Watch presentation down into kind of different sections. And so what we just kind of talked about was like just the design and the UI and sort of the basic sorts of functionality. But another big element behind the Apple Watch is health and fitness, motivating people to be more active. So it's going to have two different applications for doing fitness stuff. So there's a fitness app and a workout app. The fitness app is more monitoring your steps just throughout your day, how much you're moving around, those sorts of things. It can give you helpful reminders saying, hey, you've been sitting too long. You know, maybe you want to get up and move around. And it uses all that sensor technology to gather that information. The workout app is more about when you're going to sit down and go through a workout. It's going to provide things like heart rate monitoring, those sorts of things. And they showed that off a little bit. And so there's definitely this big health and fitness element. It'll integrate with the health app on your iPhone if you'd like to do that and send that data, which will then make that data available to other third-party apps. What was interesting about the whole health and fitness thing, an immediate question that came out from a lot of people is, well, is the Apple Watch waterproof? You know, what can I do? And I wondered that immediately as well, because I swim. I like to swim, and I, you know, prefer to have a watch that I can actually wear and sort of track time and do those sorts of things. And especially if it's going to be monitoring things like my pulse and heart rate and all those sorts of things, I'd want to be able to be wearing that while I'm working out. Well, it turns out David Pogue was able to confirm that it is water resistant, so it'll be able to repel sweat. You can wash your hands with it. It is not waterproof. And I've also mentioned during one of the videos that it had a water-resistant speaker, but water-resistant is not waterproof. So you're not going to be able to take this thing underwater. You're not going to be able to go diving with it. To me, this seems like a little bit of an oversight because you've got triathletes out there. So if you're training for a triathlon or in a triathlon and you want to use your Apple Watch to monitor that stuff, you're not going to be able to do it. You're not going to be able to wear that during your event or during your workouts, or at least not when you get into the water. You're going to have to kind of leave it behind in your bag or whatever it might be, which doesn't make a lot of sense. So hopefully that's something that gets remedied in future generations of the Apple Watch. But the good news is that Apple Pay, Apple's payment system, will work with the Apple Watch. And if you're wondering about security there because you don't have the Touch ID sensor, Apple did something very, very smart. And again, they didn't talk about this in the actual keynote, but through some of the hands-on stuff and some of the things I've been reading, someone found out that when you put the watch on for the first time, it can sense that, hey, I'm being worn by someone right now. And it'll ask you to set up, if you're using Apple Pay, a lock code. So you'll set up a lock code. And then what happens is that anytime you remove the watch, when you put it back on, you're not allowed to use Apple Pay until you actually put in the code. So you have to enter the code once you put the watch back on. As long as the watch is on, you don't have to enter the code again because, you know, it knows that you've already done that. But again, the second you remove it, it'll relock itself, which is genius. I mean, it's the way you would expect something like that to work. And one of those things that, you know, just Apple thinks about, and often, you know, other companies just would overlook something like that. They wouldn't even think about that. They have some complex system where you have to unlock it every time. It wouldn't use the sensors, those sorts of things. So I think that's just really brilliant. It just goes to show how much thought Apple put into sort of every aspect of how the Apple Watch would work. If you can't tell, I'm pretty excited about the Apple Watch. I think it does raise the bar for smartwatches that are out on the market. I think Apple has really thought out a lot of the user experiences and user interactions. The big question is going to be, is it going to be enough for enough people to make the product successful? Is it going to be enough to get me to continue to wear a watch? You know, I wore my Pebble for quite a while, but I sort of stopped wearing it because doing things like charging it and remembering to charge it and those sorts of stuff became a hassle versus, you know, how much I was actually using it. Frankly, the number one thing that I used it for was there was a great Starbucks app that I could pay at Starbucks. So it may be that Apple Pay is the killer app on the Apple Watch, because you're going to want to wear that on your wrist and you'll just never have to take your phone out of the pocket. You're just going to pay by weight, you know, touching your watch to the little tap to pay system and away you go. I don't know how that works though with the Touch ID. I'm wondering if I touch my watch, am I going to have to take my phone out and do the whole Touch ID thing? I would assume yes. So maybe it's not going to be all that convenient. I don't know. Maybe I'll just prefer to take my phone out of my pocket. We'll have to wait and see on that one. But you know, the good news there is that while the if you have an iPhone, you're going to need to have a 6 or 6 Plus to be able to use Apple Pay. If you have an iWatch or an Apple Watch, you're going to be able to do it even if you have an iPhone 5, 5C, or 5S, because the 5, 5C, and 5S are all supported by the Apple Watch. So it will be a way to sort of get into the touch to the Apple Pay system without having to upgrade your phone. You're going to be paying pretty close to the same price, if not a little bit more. So I don't know if that helps at all or not. So let's talk a little bit about pricing and availability. But before we get to that, real quickly, some other features that Tim Cook just sort of mentioned in passing. Has a walkie-talkie feature. So I would assume like wrist-to-wrist communication from Apple Watch to Apple Watch, but maybe you can also go from Apple Watch to Apple phone. I don't know if this is leveraging the voice messages in the Messages app or not. It wasn't really clear on that, but that's kind of cool. You can use it as a viewfinder for your iPhone camera, so I would assume this is great if you're setting up a remote shot and you want to sort of film yourself, or maybe you just need to take a shot and you want it to be nice and steady. You'll be able to activate the iPhone camera from the Apple Watch. Tim Cook mentioned he uses it to control his Apple TV, so another sort of home automation application for the watch, being able to, you know, control different devices around your house, specifically in this case the Apple TV. That makes a lot of sense. So I think there's going to be a lot of amazing applications, and this is only going to get better. We're just seeing the tip of the iceberg here. Because as far as when it's going to be available, Apple said available early 2015. So unfortunately, we're not going to be able to buy one now. We're going to have to wait until early 2015. And just between you and me, my translation of Apple speak to early 2015 probably means March, you know, first quarter, but end of first quarter. And it could even be later. You know, it depends on what you want to call early 2015. I think Apple's given themselves some time because if you look at what was going on in the hands-on demo area, they had sort of a plugged-in running demo, so they would let the media try the watch on, but they weren't allowed to touch it. And then the people sort of demonstrating the Apple Watch, they would go through the functions and controls very deliberately. So I think what they were showing off is still in pretty early stages of development. And that goes into one of the other big questions I guess we should mention too, because you're probably thinking this, well, what is the battery life like? You know, how long is this thing going to last? And this has been a key sort of detractor for some of the other products that are out on the market right now, is that the battery life just stinks. As a matter of fact, the Moto 360, which I think is the best smartwatch out on the market to date in terms of design and style, it's getting less than a day of battery life, according to a lot of the reviews that I read, which is not good. You need to be able to get through a full, probably 14, or more importantly, probably 20-hour day. You know, it's got to have at least a 14 to 20-hour battery life in my mind, and it should have more than that. And we've been hearing rumors that Apple's been struggling with the battery life. I mean, it is a small device, so it's going to be a big, big challenge, and it's doing a lot of stuff. I think that's why it doesn't have things like Wi-Fi, why it's sort of tethered to an iPhone. I think Apple's had to make some compromises in order to get the battery even to a point where it's something that's usable. So it's sounding right now, from what we're hearing, is that they're saying you're going to need to charge it at night, which means a day of battery life. But Apple still has until sometime in 2015 to work this out. So it may get better. But I think if they can get to at least a full day of battery life, I would hope 20 hours of battery life on a charge, I think that'll be okay. And most of us have gotten used to, with our technology, using it throughout the day, plugging it in at night, and then having it ready to go the next morning. Not ideal, but that's where it stands. As far as pricing goes, all we know is it's going to start at $349. One of the articles I read from a fashion blog said that $349 price point is for the Apple Sport Edition. I myself and a few other people, I think we were thinking the Apple Watch was the sort of base model, because when they announced the collections, they said Apple Watch, Apple Sport, and then Apple Collection, which is the gold ones, which we know are going to be on the high end. But I think because the Apple Watch Sport is the non-sapphire glass display, and we know that sapphire is expensive to do, I think that's why it might be the lower price pointed one. And it also just comes with the polymer straps in terms of the options. So I think those materials are a little bit cheaper to manufacture and put together. So that's probably what you're going to have at the $349 price point. And then pricing is going to go up from there. We don't know how much. On the Apple Edition watches, I would assume that they could go above $1,000. It would not shock me if the gold editions were above $1,000. And if you remember, KGI analyst Ming Chai Kuo said that, you know, Apple Watch pricing was going to be variable. There's going to be a lot of options, and that some of the options could be as high as several thousand dollars. I don't think they're going to go that high, but I could see it in the, you know, 800, 900, maybe even over 1,000 range for those gold edition models. And something else I forgot to mention about the gold edition models that's kind of cool is David Pogue also discovered that they're going to come kind of in this, what they're calling a jewelry box. And within that jewelry box is going to have the MagSafe charging stand for the watch. So you'll be able to put it back in the box at night and actually have it charged up. But I don't know if for my own money, that's going to be worth the price. And frankly, I don't know what it is about jewelry or that sort of fashion industry. I think the gold ones, I don't like the styling. You know, I think it's personal choice. And I think Apple was very smart about that. They have a big range here of designs and styles. So you're going to be able to find the Apple Watch that sort of fits your style and matches your personality. And I think that that's really important when you're talking about this type of device. I think the one thing that Apple really hammered home is that this is really the most personal sort of product that they've ever done, because, you know, it's attached to you. It's your style. It says a statement. You're going to be wearing it all the time. It's visible. You know, your iPhone slides into your pocket. So you can maybe customize your iPhone with a case, something like that, but you don't see a lot of that. You see a little bit more with the stickers and things like that on MacBooks and MacBook Pros, and there's, you know, a little bit of your style comes out, but this thing's like front and center. It's right there. And that's sort of really important. And Apple, you know, I think hit it home on this one. So they're getting great reviews so far. People who have seen them are very excited about them. I'm very excited about it. I think there's no doubt I'm going to be getting one. Now I'm just, again, trying to decide which model I'm going to go with. But I think I'm going to go probably with the Sport Edition with a black band. I'm, you know, very basic kind of guy. And I think that's where I'll wind up, in case you're wondering. But that's today. I've got lots of time to decide. And again, a lot of things could change. There could be a lot of flux with the Apple Watch. We'll just have to stay tuned and, you know, follow the rumor mills and follow what Apple is doing. But that was sort of everything. Again, at the end of it, they always bring it back to music. And they had U2 come out and perform. They did this little awkward thing with U2 and Bono between Tim Cook. It was really kind of forced. In essence, what they were trying to do is say, we're having a promotion. U2's new album, Apple has actually paid the record label and paid U2 to be able to give that away on iTunes, I think through mid-October. So everyone who has an iTunes account, I think they said 500 million iTunes account holders, everybody gets a free copy of the album. And what Apple did was basically just drop that into your purchases in iTunes, although a lot of people had trouble finding it, myself included. It took forever to figure out where the album was, how I got it. So I'll just share this little tip with you real quick here at the end. If you go into iTunes, go into the iTunes store, click on purchases, go to recent purchases, you should see the album Songs of Innocence by U2 in there with the little iCloud download option. Click on the download button. Once it downloads into your iTunes library, then it starts to show up every place else. So if you use iTunes Music Match or what have you, it will start to show up on your other devices. I think you can also go into the iTunes purchased area within, say, the iTunes app on your iOS device and probably find it there as well and download it from there. But that was everything. The last thing that I guess I want to share with you is that I did have a couple of you send in some audio comments with your thoughts on the event, and I just wanted to play those for you now.
Hey there, Adam. Just giving you a quick call about the Apple event that happened early on today. I'm calling from the UK, so it happened about 4 hours ago, so still thinking about what to make of the event. Overall, as a diehard Apple fan, I'm pretty happy with what I saw. I thought it was a pretty good event. Still a bit pissed off about the streaming on the Apple website, as I'm sure you was and everyone else was. Quite crazy how they've had so much time to actually get it all done and ready, but it just didn't work straight away, and then kept on like working and not working. It was unbelievable, but I think we got the gist of it anyway in the end. But yeah, the iPhone 6 and the iPhone 6 Plus, really happy with both of them. I think people were probably expecting something absolutely, you know, mind-boggling and amazing. I think it was really good, but just, I don't know, at this point, I don't think we can actually expect anything, you know, like mega, mega brand new, awesome, you know what I mean? It's, I think it's a really nice, good update to the iPhone series. I mean, I'm due an upgrade actually now, so I definitely will get one. I've got a few months left on me, iPhone 5, so I will definitely get one. I will get the iPhone 6 Plus one, because I've seen all my friends have got Samsung Note 3s, and to be fair, I do like the size of them. I know you're not a massive fan of the big screens, but I do like them. They do add to the experience, in my opinion, but I know you have a different view on that. With the Apple Watch, I tried, because there was so much information there, trying to get my head around it and try and find out what I can about it. I'm still actually digesting it all. And again, a lot of my friends have got Samsung Gear and stuff, and I've played around with it and stuff, and it seems pretty good. Again, all this new technology, trying to get me all around it and work out, you know, if I actually will use it, or rather if I actually need it, because I mean, as I said before, I'm a hardcore Apple fan. I might just go, oh, I'll buy it, whatever, you know, if I actually need it. But do I need it? I don't know. We'll see when it comes around. I probably will try one, and I put a willpower one in the end. It's just there's just so much information to take in. You know what? It probably will be absolutely amazing when we'll get used to it and stuff, because the amount of features on it compared to the Gears and the other smartwatches was absolutely insane. So I really hope that Apple have hit a home run with this one and knocked all the other competitors out the park. As you've said plenty of times in the last few weeks, Apple, they've bided their time. They didn't rush it like a lot of other companies have done. They took the time and they've come out with this device. So let's hope it is the best out of the lot, which Apple being Apple, I think they probably will do. But let's see when it comes out and what it's like once we get our hands on it. Anyways, love the show as always, and I'll talk to you soon.
Hey, thanks, Andy. Yeah, I'm in agreement with you on most of that stuff, as you can tell. And, you know, I'm waffling on which phone I'm going to get. And I know I'm going to get a lot of flack from folks who say, "Well, you said you weren't going to get the big one," and I may end up with the larger one for a lot of the reasons that you stated there. You know, like, you start looking at the UI and some of the advantages, and now I'm starting to see it. I guess I'm seeing the light now that I actually see the thing demoed and I see sort of those side-by-side screen comparisons and that sort of thing. But I'm still wrestling with the size, you know, and that's the kind of thing where you don't really know till you actually have it in your hand, which is why I'm dealing with this little paper template thing. And I'll pick it up. I'll think I want to go with the large one, pick it up, and then go, "Ugh, no, it's too big. It's too big." And I don't want to have that regret. But I also don't want to have the regret the other way, where I now have the iPhone 6 and go, "Wow, I really wish I had the image stabilization, or I wish I was able to do some of the, you know, cooler UI things that are going to be being done with the different apps and stuff." Like, I don't want to feel like I'm missing out on the full experience of the new device. And especially, you know, doing a podcast like this, I think it's kind of important that I be able to talk to all those different elements and things like that. But maybe there I'm just making excuses as to why I need to buy it. And even my wife called me out and said, "You know, you do this a lot where you think there's, you know, one thing that you don't like or aren't going to like, and then you live with it for a couple weeks and then you're totally happy with it." And she's absolutely correct. This happened when we went to the 4-inch screen from the 3.5-inch screen. It was really weird at first, you know, the sort of height change, and it took a couple of weeks to get used to, but then it was just sort of the norm, and then you kind of can't see yourself going back. And so I have to wonder and think if it's going to be that sort of experience for me. The one dilemma I know I'm going to have is I'm going to not be able to carry the phone the way I've always carried my phone, which is in my front jean pocket. That thing is just too big for that. I know that with absolute certainty. I'll either snap the screen when I'm sitting down or just feel like, you know, I've got like a splint in my leg. It's just like putting a giant plank down my, I put mine in my left pocket, so like right across the top of my left leg. So I don't know, maybe more cargo pants are in my future. Maybe that's the way around it. Who knows? But yeah, absolutely. And the watch, I'm just very excited about. I think I already stated Apple really hit this one out of the park, and I think there's going to be a lot of Apple's competitors going, "Wow, we should have waited to see what Apple's going to do so we knew what direction to take this thing in." But, you know, like you said, we're just going to have to wait and see until we get these things in our hands, how they look and feel and, you know, what the use cases end up being. But Apple thinks all that stuff out for us ahead of time, so I think we're all going to be completely blown away.
Hi, Adam. This is Dave from Geekanoids, and I wanted to share with you my thoughts on the new Apple Watch. Now, obviously, I'm super excited about the iPhone 6 and iPhone 6 Plus as well. But the Apple Watch really captured my imagination and my attention a great deal more, purely because it's a whole new category for Apple. Now, obviously, the category of smartwatches and wearable tech have been around for a while now, but what Apple do really well is they sit back and watch other manufacturers, and I'm sure they have a team that really see how end users react to other devices in this particular space. And then they improve upon that. And with the Apple Watch, what's really amazed me is how absolutely gorgeous and beautiful the design looks and how they've reimagined the user interface. Now, obviously, only time will tell when we get these in our hands or on our wrists, for want of a better term, as to how well they perform. But for me, it certainly looks like a very interesting device.
I think it looks like an interesting device, too. I'm very, very excited about it. I do want to comment. I'm not sure I agree with you 100% on Apple sort of waiting to see what other companies do and then sort of analyzing it, seeing where they go wrong and improving upon it. There may be a little bit of that. But I don't think it's sort of the direct thing that Apple does. My sense has always been that Apple looks for an area, a sort of market that they can go into and disrupt, improve the user experience in. So they may look at it from that perspective, look at, okay, here's a category, smartwatches, there's a bunch of people doing stuff in this space, but nothing's really working. We need to jump in there and do something to change it, to sort of create the market for that. But I think beyond that, I don't think they spend a lot of time going, well, you know, this is what Samsung's doing wrong, and this is what this company's doing wrong. I think they more look at, go, okay, this is a category that needs improvement. And then I think they take it from there all on their own and sort of go, where can we make a difference? I think they turn it on the consumer rather than the manufacturer. So they're not looking at who's providing the solutions. They're looking at the consumer, what solutions maybe they're buying, and then why those solutions aren't working for them. And then they say, okay, how can we improve this experience? Not only improve it, but make it, you know, infinitely better and really deliver the product that the consumer's looking for that they're not getting. And that's a key for success, right? If you can do that, meet the needs of the consumer and put them first, then, you know, the success of the product, I think, naturally follows. And Apple's learned this time and time again. And it seems so basic when you sort of put it in those terms to me, but so many companies don't seem to get it, right? They're too focused on the technology, on, I think, their own self-interests, on making sure that they look good, that sort of thing. Apple is really looking to make our lives better, and in the process knows that we are going to continue to buy their products because they do it over and over again. So, you know, I think they went in and said, we need to learn everything about the spaces that we possibly can. And I think if you look at all the hiring and just all the stuff that was mentioned by Cook and Ive in his little videos in the keynote, you know, that's where Apple put their efforts. And that's why they're able to deliver such an amazing product that really hits all the points that consumers are going to be concerned about. The fashion of the device, utility of the device, the functions of the device, the technology in the device. Those are all things that are important, but they all go into the bigger thing, which is that experience that the customer has. How am I going to interact with this thing on a daily basis? How is it going to improve my life? How is it going to make sure that I'm getting up and not sitting at my desk and my health gets better? How is it going to make sure that, you know, I can get to my meetings and I set my appointments and sort of run my day better? How is it going to enhance the experience that I already have with the phone that's in my pocket? You know, what is it going to bring to the table that I can't do with just the phone alone? And I think they hit a lot of those high points, and I think that's why it's going to be so successful. But I definitely appreciate the feedback, and, you know, I do think you're right on some level. They do kind of pay attention to that, but I just don't know if it's that much of a core. That said, I do want to mention that Dave from Geekanoids, he has his own YouTube channel and does all kinds of tech reviews and tech-related, nerd-related videos. Obviously, a Mac fan, been a listener and part of the MacCast community since almost the very beginning. Dave's been sending me stuff, and he does really great work. So if you haven't checked it out, you should go check out his YouTube channel, Geekanoids, and also the website, geekanoids.co.uk. And I think he just posted a video where he sampled every single iWatch design in a paper template, which is really interesting to watch. So those are the kinds of things he does. Also great reviews and just looks at all kinds of different types of technology. So check that out. And Dave, thanks for sending in your feedback. Much appreciated. Now, before we end the show, we have just a few more things, a little more than one more thing. Some stuff that happened after the Apple event, not necessarily directly related to it, but some things that I wanted to make you aware of. One kind of big thing, Apple quietly sort of killed off the iPod Classic. Did you notice? Not a lot of people did, or at least not immediately. And then the media kind of caught on, and it was true. Apple removed the iPod Classic from the website. You can't even find it in the refurbished store. They took it off the shelves at their, you know, off the counters at the retail stores. So it's looking to be gone. So if you have one of those, you know, have a classic collector's item. I guess it's always been right there in the name, but now it's truly classic. And the only reasoning most of us can think of is that because we have 128 gigabyte option on the iPhone now, Apple just felt it was time to retire that product. And I would guess also this likely bodes well for the fact that we may get 128 gigabyte iPod Touches sometime in the near future. The only bummer is that the price point of the iPod Classic was really nice for the storage size. So if you had a device that you needed to store a lot of music on, that was your go-to option. Now you're probably going to have to pay a little bit more to get a similar sized amount of storage. And obviously in an iPod Touch or an iPhone, you've got other stuff on there besides music. So that big, big music device no longer available. Apple also did release iTunes 11.4 update, basically adding support for iOS 8, which will be with us next week. And then lastly, they revised some of the iCloud pricing, I guess probably also in anticipation of iOS 8, which is going to have much more iCloud integration, including iCloud Photos. If you want to start storing a lot of your photo library up into iCloud, you're going to be using up a lot more storage. So that 5 gigabyte free plan might not work for everyone. So now with the new pricing, you can get 20 gigabytes of storage for 99 cents a month, 200 gigabytes of iCloud storage for $3.99 a month. And of course, these prices are all in US dollars. 500 gigabytes for $9.99 a month, and a full 1 terabyte for $19.99 a month. Now, just in comparison, Dropbox recently, I think, reduced their prices. With them, you can get a terabyte for $9.99 a month, so about half the cost of iCloud. But you know, then it's not going to integrate necessarily like iCloud. I know a lot of apps do, but if you want that built-in storage, you want to be able to use the stuff with the iCloud service. That's still a pretty good price for 1 terabyte of online storage. So Apple trying to get at least a little bit more competitive, not fully competitive, with some of the other solutions that are out there on the market. But with that, I think that is going to do it for this episode. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Gazelle, hey, if you're looking to get that iPhone 6 and you want to sell your old device, Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what that used iPhone or even iPads or other Apple products are worth over at gazelle.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, as well as PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, along with PDF Pen Scan Plus, all great apps and software you should check out. You can get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. And lynda.com. Lynda helps keep you up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, and explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free trial of lynda.com by going to lynda.com/maccast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. I'd also like to thank a couple of our supporters. Bandwidth for the Maccast is provided by Cashfly at cachefly.com. And all advertising on Maccast is handled by Backbeat Media. You can find them over at backbeatmedia.com. If you have any feedback for me, you have an audio comment, you want to, you know, give your thoughts on the iPhone 6, the 6 Plus, maybe some of the other announcements. Are you getting an iWatch? I'd love to know what your thoughts on that are. If you want to give me any of that feedback, you can shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com. I also really welcome audio comments. If you just want to do a quick audio recording and attach it to your email and send it to me, that would be great. If you'd prefer to just call in on the voicemail line, you can do that, 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9, and you can just leave a voicemail. And if you send me an audio comment, there's a good chance you'd probably be on a future episode of the MacCast. So if you'd like to be on, that's the best way to do that. Show notes for this and every other episode of the MacCast can be found on the website over at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. If you'd like to follow me on Twitter, you'll find me at twitter.com/maccast, or you can check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. And we also have a Google Plus community. If you're on Google Plus, just search for MacCast and you'll find us there. But for now, That'll do it. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.